You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Professor Carlton Shieldsheep-Gover, and I am excited to have you join me as we take a journey through the rich and fascinating histories and archaeologies of North America's Great Plains. So this week is a promo episode. It is that time of the year of theses, dissertation defenses, end-of-year parties, and apparently Canva getting hacked, which has affected like hundreds, if not thousands, of institutions across the country, including the University of Kansas. So a bit hectic this past week. And so we're just going to take a break, enjoy this promo episode, and then we will be back on with the regular summer programming. And we have some exciting news to share on next episode. So with that, enjoy this episode. I'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Welcome to episode 30-something of Ethnosinology. I'm your host, David Ian Howe, and I am joined today with Dr. Jesse Toon, Dr. Spencer Pelton, Dr. Carlton Shieldsheep-Gover, Dr. Darcy Shane Miller, and Dr. Shane Miller, and me, who is without PhD. So last week we talked about Monte Verde. We had Dr. Todd Surabel on to speak about the new findings that came out of the site. And today I figured I'd bring on some other researchers I know who I've worked with my entire life. Shane and Jesse, I've known you more than a decade, which is crazy, but we can talk about pleasantries later. Carlton, I've known through school. Spencer, I've also known more than a decade now. Yeah, so I guess we'll just get started. Can you all just introduce yourselves, who you are first? Let's just do that first.
I'm Spencer Pelton. I'm in Wyoming, state archaeologist. Let me just know, most of us here are from Tennessee.
That is true.
Except for Carlton. Sorry, bud.
He's been there.
More like the Tennessee Mafia, right?
This is the Tennessee Paleo Mafia. Yeah. But yeah, any other introduction you want to give state archaeologists?
I'm the state archaeologist for the state of Wyoming. I live in Laramie. A little sunburned right now.
Okay. That we can see for the video people. Jesse?
Jesse Toon. So I'm an associate professor of archaeology and the director for the Center of Archaeological Research at the University of Mississippi. Also from Tennessee. Go Vols.
Go Vols. Dr. Miller?
Shane Miller. I'm at the University of Alabama in the Department of Anthropology. Also from Tennessee. Go Vols. And I think I've known you the longest in the chat. Since like 2010, right?
2012 was our field school, my field school. Yeah. And you were a graduate student at Arizona when I was there.
Correct.
Dr. Gover?
Absolutely. Dr. Carlton Shieldsheep-Gover, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Kansas and the curator of archaeology for the Biodiversity Institute Natural History Museum at KU. Yeah, only one that didn't go to a Tennessee school. I also don't do Paleo-Indian lithics or people in the Americas. I do Central Great Plains farmers from 1,000 years ago. So I'm definitely cutting across the grain, but happy to be here. And then David, I will have known you a decade in August of this year.
Awesome. So with that said, I got a lot of questions and comments to that video, a lot of emails. Several of them addressed me as doctor, which I was quite happy with. Doctors, Sir Bill and Howe, chewing me out. But
Dr. Howe, you are an idiot.
Yeah.
Started more, strong.
There was more like just questions about like, well, what about this or the tephra? How didn't they do that? So Spencer, you spent the most time around Todd while he was doing this. Could you just like quickly explain your like analysis of what happened just like in the quickest way? Like,
I mean, Todd's always been obsessed with Monte Verde. Somebody that studies people in the Americas. Somewhere around 2020 or 2021, he started talking to me about seaweed and can we really know what is seaweed? Something along those lines. Very, very vast simplification of it. So he had an idea of testing seaweed for isotopes instead of looking at like the cellular structure of it, which is, I think, how it was identified back in the 90s. I found out the seaweed burned up in a fire, but was like, oh, well, I'm going to Chile anyway. It's a cool place. I went down there, met up with some colleagues, and quickly realized that the Monteverde II locality excavations were in a terrace that local geomorphologists have always identified as a Holocene terrace in this kind of larger alluvial system. And so that brief realization led to a longer-term project in which they dated sediments up and down the system, including right adjacent to the excavated Monteverde site. And they found out that all of those amazing organic artifacts within the Monteverde II site were redeposited from a bog deposit, basically like a dead forest and a bunch of decaying matter on a higher and older terrace of this stream system. So you can imagine, you know, when streams are meandering back and forth, sometimes they undercut a bank and you kind of get these like in these curves of the river. And when you undercut that bank, all the stuff above it collapses on into the river system eventually. That's basically what happened, is that as this river, this creek was meandering and incising its channel, it undercut banks and it redeposited really old carbon into a much younger stratigraphic context. And it's a tricky situation. I mean, it has happened. I've seen it happen before in sites in Wyoming, but it doesn't happen routinely. And so, yeah, it's a tricky situation to parse out, but I think they did it really well.
Gotcha. Dr. Miller, as a geoarchaeologist, what were your thoughts on the study?
First off, I just had like this image of Todd cornering Spencer and saying, "What is even a seaweed?" or something like that.
Can we even know what seaweed is? Maybe it's different for every person.
Yeah. I've heard a little like on and off that Todd was poking around the Monteverde stuff for a while. Like, you know, he chit chat on the phone about various things from time to time. Not a lot, but just enough to know that he was tinkering on it. And, you know, going back to like some of the older critiques, and, you know, I don't think Todd is the first person to say, "Hey, maybe this is all redeposited." And I was spending some time before this trying to go back over some of the older critiques. I think that maybe like Tom Lynch and like one of the original critiques argued that like it may have been redeposited or something like that. This is like mining my memory from grad school days.
No, you're right. These ideas have been around for a while.
Yeah. And so I was like, this is like the first where it's like laid out in that one figure where it's like, here's a sequence of events that happen. And it's very simple that you've got that tephra deposit. And if you just had a little bit of like training in like basin cut and fill sequences from fluvial geology 101, you're like, well, that channel containing the site had to come after that tephra, and the age of that tephra is known. So, I mean, I read it and I was like, I think this is really hard to come back from. If you're the Monteverde gang, this seems pretty damning to me.
What is tephra? Like, I'm not a geoarchaeologist, so some of the terms, like, I'm not necessarily familiar with. Like, I can kind of understand some of these figures. Like, I understand the point, and I, you know, as also a professor who teaches, you know, this stuff, but like, what is tephra? Like, what are these sequences that Todd is talking about in this paper?
Can I link you a 45-minute video?
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it. Yes.
No, go for it.
It's volcanic ash. That's it.
Yeah. It's volcanic ash. It's like another fancy word for a layer of volcanic ash. And in some places in the world, they're pretty distinct and people can geochemically pick them out with a high degree of confidence. And this one in particular is apparently pretty well dated. So they know how old that eruption is, and they know that ash is from that eruption, and that ash postdates when they said the Monteverde site was supposed to be. So I think it dates like 11,000 or something like that. So that channel containing the archaeological site came after that ash was deposited.
I think that one thing that people have struggled to understand with this study, I've seen this in like some of your comments and stuff, is like how can something deeper in the ground be younger than something higher up elevationally? And the way I've thought of to describe this easily is like we do this when we plant like a tree or a shrub in our yard, right? You dig a hole through dirt that could be 100 or 1,000 years old or something. You put the plant in there and then you fill that hole with much younger dirt. So even though the dirt in that hole is much younger, it's the same elevation, but it's much younger than the dirt surrounding it. That's essentially how fluvial geomorphology works in a very simplified version. Is dirt is removed and younger dirt is replaced in the place where that older dirt used to be.
And then to kind of add on to that, right, the bottom of that hole where the tree roots end up being located, right, those tree roots in the tree is much younger than the dirt at the top too, right?
Right.
So, Jesse, you went to Texas A&M, and I saw one of the critiques in the news from Meltzer and Waters was something to do with the GeoArc. Are you able to speak to that, what that critique was? I can't recall it myself at the moment. Obviously, it's egregiously poor archaeological work or something like that, but what were they saying?
So if I'm remembering kind of the sequence of critiques that were published in some of like the AAAS and Live Science things, right? There were some questions raised about why other kind of specialized analyses weren't conducted. You know, why wasn't cryptotephra identified? So like kind of microscopic, you know, layers of tephra, individual volcanic ash grains and that kind of stuff. Why weren't some of the bones geochemically identified to match between different geologic deposits? I think there was something about the wood. Why wasn't the wood identified? There seemed to be a lot of these kind of subsequent or ancillary and very specialized analyses that we might see in geoarchaeology, right? I did some of that work myself when I was at Texas A&M, part of my dissertation with Mike Waters. We were working on another site in Tennessee, the Coates Hines Litchi site. We went back to a site that, you know, was presumably pre-Clovis in time and nature. And so we went back and did some of those analyses, and it came out to be unrelated to humans, absolutely. But that's a different situation, I believe, than in this case at Monte Verde. I don't know that all of those kind of specialized analyses are necessarily required in this case, largely because of the tephra issue, in my opinion. Again, kind of going back to that, that's, yeah, pretty interesting that seems to really answer a lot of the geoarchaeological questions.
Yeah. Okay.
And the OSL dates within that strat too, where you've got the old bones with the young sand grains or the mid-Holocene sand grains. You put those two things together and it's blunt force geomorph. I'm not convinced you need to do all of those things to make a convincing case.
Right. No, I mean, a lot of that stuff, there's just no reason in doing that at this point and with this study that Todd and colleagues were doing.
You could have almost done this on the tephra alone without any radiocarbon dating or OSL dating. I mean, you could do this. You could have done this old school with stratigraphy. Knowing the age of that tephra, that work would have had to have been done, but you could have just profiled the terraces and your answer would have been right there. Identify the tephra, obviously, but... I know. I think they went above and beyond to prove the case. But
yeah, Carlton, at KU with your students or grad students or undergrads that you've seen, what's some of the chatter about the site that you've heard? I know Hoops messaged and said he liked the video. But I don't know if he agreed with it or not.
Yeah. So, right. I think I'm very fortunate at my department in that we're a pretty processual department at KU, and it is also an outlier in my own department. Like, it is very people in the Americas focused, and like, we're very fortunate that we have Ted Gable and Kelly Graff, who do Beringian archaeology, Eastern Russian, like Siberian archaeology. They're looking at people in the Americas from the Beringian aspect. Like, what is that connecting piece between Beringia and Clovis. We have Dr. Jenny Raff and Dr. Dennis O'Rourke, who are doing the ADNA aspects of Peopling the Americas. And so we kind of have this multi-pronged approach of what people are looking at. And I'm over here looking at corn in Nebraska. But I'm surrounded by a lot of people that are engaged in these debates. And we hosted Todd last year. He gave a department talk, and he talked about one of his papers looking at the context, the stratigraphic context of a site, being able to calculate that based on the positioning of artifacts distributed within a layer. And, you know, we also have the state geoarchaeologist, or former state geologist, who's a geoarchaeologist, Rolf Mandel, who did the geoarchaeology of the Great Plains and is also one of the Odyssey program directors, who looks at Great Plains origins of peoples. So needless to say, like just setting up the stage, like I'm around a lot of people that are doing this work. We had Todd and he was fantastic. But my department is fundamentally leans towards pre-Clovis, but from a very processual standpoint. And like at Todd's talk with Steve Holland, the author of the Cerruti, and like they had a fan, like Todd was welcomed, and there was great talks with Todd about a number of things, and it was very professional, and I thought it went really well. Some grad students, I think, struggled with the paper because, you know, it shattered a lot of people's worldview very quickly, right? Because Monteverde was pedestaled as like, it is the pre-Clovis site that has an assemblage, right? And that has always been the critique of like, what the hell is pre-Clovis? Is like, there's not a diagnostic toolkit, but Monteverde had one. And, I think a lot of them were just kind of struggling with it, and they are early career grad students for the most part, so they might not have had the geoarchaeology. So I think it was also trying to interpret the article, but I've been very supportive of it. Todd gave me a demo, like he maybe put my phone down, make sure I wasn't recording, but he like showed me on my whiteboard, did the diagram of this figure, and then he erased it afterwards, of course, but like he walked me through what was going on. So overall, I think people are just kind of settling with it. People in the state geology office, the Kansas Geological Survey, seem very supportive of it. They think the geology checks out, but at the same time, I've seen other geoarchaeologists that have come out of this program that like someone commented to me personally, because I was sharing this, and said, you know, I would have flagged a T3 surface being somehow erosional. It's one of the most nonsensical sentences I have read. A terrace is not an erosional surface. And I'm just like, I don't know, man. Look at the figures. Like, look at the supplemental material.
That's not true, but whatever.
Right.
Like, an erosional terrace is a strath terrace. It's just either a terrace can, like, build up in a floodplain, or it erodes down through an existing deposit. Stabilizes, or it could be a little bit of both. You can erode down, and then you can get some overbank on top of it. It's weird to consider geomorphology dynamics in that sort of like draconian terms of like, no, there are these two things or this one thing, and it's always like that forever. It's just not how the earth moves, really.
We can go to Tennessee right now, or Western North Carolina, and you can go to an ice age terrace that's got about 2 feet of sediment from Hurricane Helene flooding on top of it. So it's a terrace.
Yeah.
You can still get dirt. Anyways.
Yeah.
We don't have to get into the weeds of terraces, but yeah, I just feel like, and I'm not trying to be like pretentious about this, but like, if you take like a principles of geomorphology, or like go a couple steps beyond and take like fluvial geomorphology, like these are things that you learn in those.
And I think an important thing to consider here with what you all are saying is there's some nuance here, right? It seems like a simple geologic story, but there's also some nuance, even if it's just, you know, how specific terraces are forming. And that's important to keep in mind. And I think that nuance is what really comes out in the fact that Todd and colleagues went back down to take a look at this, right? A lot of the critique, either side, the critique of Dillehay or critique of Surivel and colleagues, right? It's lost unless you've actually been there to take a look at it, it seems like.
Right. And I can say, working on the video with Todd, it was like, what I did was have him talk, obviously, then I added footage over top, and then I was like, what terrace do I put here? And then I had to like sit down with, because I wasn't there, so that made it very difficult to understand. I mean, I was looking at the manuscript that I had and trying to match it up myself, and even like me editing the video, I was like, what This might be very difficult for a layman audience to figure out. And I've taken GeoArc with Todd. I've not been to Monteverde. So I think that's a major hangup for people. And I also said to Todd, too, like, it's such a complex smoking gun, like with the tephra and like how it deposits under, that like I think most people, if they see this, are just going to have to accept. I don't know what he's talking about, but he sounds like he knows what he's talking about with it, because like, the GeoArc is so confusing. But I feel like with the graphs that I animated and stuff and the ones in the paper, you can see that the tephra, you know, isn't where it should be, like at Monteverde, and it's all mixed context. And like the Pleistocene animals are washing down, and then people are saying, what about the tent stakes? How did they not know the artifacts at the time were also Holocene in era, like all that, so questions like that. And then all that tangent aside, another good question I saw was, why didn't they date the tephra? Why didn't they notice the tephra in the 90s? Do you guys have an answer to that?
Because, I mean, I have my suspicions, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, from what I understand, right, this particular tephra, I forget the name of it, it starts with the T, right? It's only really been recently identified throughout the kind of surrounding region and dated since the original work there at Monteverde, right? There are some additional tephras maybe that were initially identified, but this particular one, kind of the big one in question right now, has come about since like 2011 or something like that.
Okay, so it was later than the site that they did all that tephra chronology of the lake and the pond course and all that. Okay. I think, yeah, because it was 2002, I think, was the citation I remember putting on there for the pollen cores.
I don't know. And like, not to go on a tangent, I've been, like, really disappointed with the echo chamber. Like, some of the results of colleagues who are, like, vehemently against this paper, some of their logic has just been disappointing, right? Like, well, someone commented, why stop listening to Todd when I found out he was a Clovis Firster? I'm like, what the fuck? Or another person said, like, well, I wish someone who believed in pre-Clovis would have looked at this site again. I'm like, the science doesn't grow. I'm like, what are you talking? Why would a pre-Clovis person reevaluate a site they already think is legit? Like, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And so just kind of seeing some of these inherent biases that really still plague the field in a way is just like not contributing to the actual critique of the paper. And I think that's been, for me, most highlighting, seeing how nitpicky some people are getting or why they don't like Todd's paper, which has nothing to do with the science or geomorphology, but on these preconceived like battle draw lines and picking sides and like, well, he's a Clovis Firster, so therefore what he says is of no value. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
That's not productive. And it's,
people
and it's
been really kind of mean, man. Like I talk to the press a lot and I sure as hell filter myself better than some of the comments I saw in print. Like, I don't know, man. Hey, that's going to be in Science Magazine forever. But whatever. It's your words. Do what you want with them.
Quick, to kind of add on to something that Carlton said a second ago, like, I don't know that it necessarily depends on where you fall in this weird constructed dichotomy of Clovis first versus pre-Clovis, or maybe there's a lot of people in the middle that are totally fine with it. I don't know. I don't know that it necessarily matters where you are on that in terms of if you should go back to a site or retest something, right? To me, the single most important thing about all of this is that they went back and took a look at it. And we're not just arguing about it as we tend to do. Shane, what were you going to say?
I was going to ask David, did you take peopling with Dave Anderson at Tennessee?
I did.
All right. Do you remember like the first lecture that Dave always does every semester whenever he used to teach class?
Yes, it is about the history of science and the art of baloney detection, Demon Haunted Worlds, the critical thinking class. Yeah.
The critical Jesse thinking and lecture. I have been texting a whole lot about that. And I have to say, like, one of the things I'm very thankful for is I took that class with Dave, and he was a big proponent of trying to cover the bases and just really think with like Carl Sagan's toolbox, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dave is pretty generous to both sides and is willing to hear both sides. And so I would just really just shout out Dave Anderson there for that, because, and then I went to Arizona and I had Vance. So Vance is not anti pre-Clovis, you know, especially not now with the footprints at White Sands. but he's also like puts a critical mind to task on things like the Younger Dryas Comet and stuff like that. So really thankful I had both those guys to help kind of navigate and think twice before what I say publicly. Because I feel like some people just don't have that filter, like Spencer was saying.
Some of the stuff has been pretty rough. Yeah. I guess you went and got the book there.
So for folks listening and watching, because I'm holding it up, if you haven't read this book, read this book frequently, every day. There's a reason that it is so worn with so many little pages marked. Read.
Yeah, I love that book, man. I read that when I was like 15. It had kind of a big influence on my career trajectory. Carl Sagan.
It has nothing to do with archaeology, but Sagan wrote and talked a lot about anthropology and archaeology and just science in general, good and bad science, and helps with tools of how to think about things critically.
And that's the Demon Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark, right? Is the name of the book? Yeah. There's a war club in front of it on my bookshelf, so I can't take it off right now, but I would also show it. Yeah, Dave teaches that lecture. Dave Anderson, shout out Dave Anderson, was my undergraduate professor. Also Shane's, very intelligent guy, did the Shiloh Mounds, did paleo stuff at Topper, does Southeastern stuff. But every class he teaches, it does start with a critical thinking. We learned Occam's Razor, was it post hoc, ergo propter hoc, all that stuff, like all the, how to detect bullshit when sites come out, which was what led me to have a skeptical mind. And I remember as an undergrad being like, I don't know about this pre-Clovis stuff being legit or not. And he was like, you should email a guy named Dr. Surville and work with him for your master's, which is where I went and worked with Bob Kelly there too. But Dave was a very good qualifier. I remember he would try to like take both sides of the opinion, which I learned pretty well from him. But with that said, I guess some of the next questions I had were, I made the joke on accident. I called Paisley Caves Pooper's Ferry, which it should be called now.
Oh, dude, that's
Paisley
good.
Caves. Paisley Caves is Copper Lights. Cooper's Ferry is the, I think a lot of people, most archaeologists agree that that is pre-Clovis. And then Galt is the other outlier to me. But Monteverde way down there is now out. So what do we, what does this paper do for the discipline now? Obviously, it's up. Now I remember what I was going to say. When sites like Paisley Caves or Pooper's Ferry or Cooper's Ferry comes out, or White Sands, especially White Sands and Cerruti, I remember my gut instinct being like, well, that can't be true. That's, you know, and my gut instinct was like, this researcher doesn't know what they're doing. So I understand where a lot of the critiques at Todd are coming from, because it's shattering your worldview, and it goes against your opinions. So what do you guys think about these other Clovis or pre-Clovis sites now? Like what kind of, how should we reassess these?
Well, I mean, like, and I want to start off just because like, I don't know the content that the other three are. So I'm kind of like teeing, I'm really kind of teeing up you, Spencer, Jesse, that, and just like, yeah, Shane, like, cause I'm an idiot of the group here. Like I've been to Meadowcroft. Like one of my, the guy that got me into archaeology, Dr. David Clark, was a grad student of Adivasio at Pitt. And when I was doing community college in Northern Virginia, we went out to Meadowcroft, and like Meadowcroft is bonkers. Like you look at that site and it's just dilapidated wall. It's coal country. And also Adivasio has never published Meadowcroft, right? It's, there's really nothing there yet because Adivasio is sitting on that data. So the fact that people talk about Meadowcroft is dumb because it's not published. Like there's nothing backing that other than Adivasio. White Sands is a whole other kettle of fish. Like we've talked about it on Ruins, one of my favorite episodes still. But like Paisley Caves and these other places, like I never liked Monteverde. It just never made sense. It didn't fit. It's way too far south. But it was used as really, you know, specifically the smoking gun for the Kelp Highway hypothesis. I don't think it disproves that, especially since a lot of those early sites, regardless of Clovis or pre-Clovis, are along the Pacific Corridor. But I don't know. And like, and Galt, like, has anyone ever seen like an image of the Galt stratigraphy? And if you have, you know, there's no stratigraphy. It's a clay wall, right? There's no strata. And how is it that this site, it also has pre-Clovis, but doesn't it also have like the earliest dates for Clovis and Folsom and almost every Paleo-Indian component? Or am I thinking of Deborah Freakin? Which one am I talking about right now?
Topper is pretty mixed like that, but who?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my take on all this stuff is like, I can nitpick each one of those sites that you listed and call to attention issues that I would have concerns about. And for the record, like, I'm completely open for there being a pre-Clovis record, and I would love for there to be. I think that would be awesome because we'd have like another several thousand years of prehistory to research in North America that we haven't had. I just haven't really seen it pop up yet. So returning to the question, like, each one of these sites, I can point to specific issues I'm concerned about, but I think ultimately what this paper at Monteverde says to me is there's an infinite number of ways for the natural world to mess with the human record and make it confusing for us to interpret in an accurate manner. And until multiple people with different histories of research and different assumptions look at these sites with their own eyes and their own kind of pre-existing ideas about how the world works, we're never going to like come to a conclusion about any of them because it's all just very complicated. And so like Todd and his team found a pretty fundamental process that was occurring in Monteverde that nobody had recognized before because the previous investigators went into it with their own ideas and they got entrenched in those ideas and they went with it. And then he goes in with a new set of eyes and kind of some new training and some new background and they saw it in a completely different light. And I suspect that if other people went into these other sites, we're talking about, you know, White Sands, Cooper's Ferry, Galt, all these sites, they would probably come to some different conclusions. They dig the site differently and they would date the site differently and they come up with new ideas about how the site formed. And so I think that's the ultimate story for me, is that it really is a benefit to producing accurate knowledge to have multiple people from different backgrounds look at these sites.
Yeah.
So not to be nitpicky, but the terminology I think is interesting and maybe interesting to other people, right? It's not that you're advocating for other research groups to go and look at a site, because that happened at Monteverde, right, in 1997.
To actually do work.
Do actual, original, independent research, right? And there's some distinction there between looking at something, whether it's published data, whether it's curated artifacts or a prepared stratigraphic profile, versus actually going and doing that research and fieldwork yourself, unsupervised, as it were.
Yeah.
So I got like a funny text to follow up on that kind of, I got a text from one of my former students, Nate Shores, who's former military Mississippi boy, working CRM right now. And he sounds like Matthew McConaughey from Dazed and Confused. And so like I read his text with his voice and he was like, "Hey man, let's go get some money together and go down there and dig that thing. Somebody else other than these people need to go down there and see what Monteverde is about." And which is true. You know, at this point, I'm like, there is two conflicting interpretations. I mean, it all, like, I hate to, like, how many times can you poke a hole down there and what can you come up with? But it feels like to resolve Monteverde, somebody else is going to have to go down there and actually do independent work. And Tune and I were talking about, this is actually not that uncommon.
It happens in other fields all the time.
Well, in the Southeast, like we've picked on Toon because he's been back to several sites now and figured out that they weren't what they were originally sold to be. To the point that we've given him the nickname Darth Toon. And then, you know, I go to like Hester in Mississippi and find out it's exactly how Sam Brooks sold it. Jesse Halligan went to Paige Latson and found, hey, it looks a lot like how Dunbar and those guys described it. And then they went in with a different group with a whole battery of new methods and basically reinforced the original story. So it's not that uncommon for independent teams to go and work on a site in some form or fashion.
You know, one of the biggest challenges of Blackwater Draw is to try to pull together all of the different research teams and the excavations that have happened at Blackwater Draw. Like, literally, you can't do it. People, multiple people, including myself, have tried to make sense of that because so many different groups of people have gone in independently and worked at the Clovis type site at Blackwater Draw. And every time they find the same or a very similar story.
I walked into Vance Haynes' office and he had graph paper laid out trying to reconstruct what the hell happened at Blackwater Draw. That man can't do it. It can't be done.
That is a drawback of having too many cooks in the kitchen, though, right?
Yeah, that is the downside, right?
Somebody, I saw someone commented, it was a less than kind comment, I'd say, but it was, I took it constructively. He said that he's worked in auditing his whole life, and what Surreville and co. did was an audit. And they went down there, wanted to find a problem with the site, tested it, and found it. And he's like, that's not how you should do science. There's something to that extent. But in my opinion, like, that's what Todd's exactly calling for, is like, not that he went down there and audited their like bills like the IRS, but like, yes, if Todd's going in there with the idea of I want to disprove pre-Clovis here and finds the easiest way to do it or the scientific way to do it, that could be what he did, but it's not. He just did geo work and it happened to disprove the site. So like, I think we, maybe auditing is not the best word, but like, we should have the Clovis Mafia audit Topper or audit Friedkin or something like that, or not audit be the right word. You know what I'm saying there?
Honestly, who cares? Because the science is sound. Like, who gives a shit? Like, they can bitch and moan all they want. Like, always auditing, coming with preconceived notions. Yeah, science is biased. Like, every archaeologist, no matter when they go to a site or look at a collection, there's an inherent bias there. We cannot remove that. That is a fundamental fact of our field. But Todd's science is sound. The geoarch is sound, regardless of trying to disprove it. Like, he did.
Yeah. I mean, others are saying it's not sound, but from what I understand and seeing all the stuff on his desk and he, like Charlie and Always Sunny with the board showing me everything he had. And I was like, all right, this is legit. Yeah. I don't know. What do you guys feel about those
statements? I do feel like that's where Fidel gets, people get frustrated, I guess, with the way he operates, because what he does, it does feel like an audit. Like, what Todd did just felt like an independent geomorph study that conflicted with the interpretation of the excavation in a way that was catastrophic to the original interpretation. I just reread Fidel's 99 critique of Monteverde of the reports. That was an audit going line by line, pointing out all the inconsistencies with labeling and associations and everything. That's an audit. And I guess like the critique of him at the time, somebody, one of the people who was writing like the responses to Fidel was basically like, no site would survive an audit like that. I kind of feel like that was disingenuous to Stu as he went through and pointed out, look, here's a whole lot of inconsistencies.
He ended up being right about a lot of that stuff too.
Yeah, and I don't know. I was curious about this. Can I ask Spencer a question? Can I ask?
Yeah, please.
So Stu gets a rap for being an auditor, right? But he's worked in the CRM field almost the entirety of his career, cranking out reports for a SHPO, right? To like get things through SHPO, right? Do you think a report like Monteverde gets any more or less scrutiny than maybe like a big report for a CRM project where there's literally millions and maybe billions of dollars on the line if something's wrong, right? Like, if there's some gross misinterpretation and somebody puts a pipeline through and hits a whole bunch of Native American burials and slows a Keystone pipeline down for a year, that could cost millions and billions, right? Like, isn't there, like, what do you think the level of scrutiny between?
I mean, I'll speak in generalities about it. Like, I mean, I was on that stratigraphic integrity paper with Todd, where we compiled a bunch of basically vertical artifact distributions from a bunch of sites in Alaska and North America and assessed like how intact they were, quote unquote, relative to the stratigraphic context. So the thing that struck me when we were going through that process was that it was a hell of a lot easier to compile those data from a CRM report that's 800 pages long that maybe five people in the world have read than it was from the most significant Paleo-Indian sites in North America. And we saw that as a real problem. Like, a lot of these earliest sites are kind of shrouded in mystery. It's really difficult to track down like very basic information about the sites. Where did artifacts come from? Like, literally just a database. It's like artifact one, northing easting elevation, artifact two, northing easting elevation, so that you can create your own graphs. You can recreate the graphs and the data that they're presenting in their paper. That's never presented. It's impossible to track down, I know for a fact, for most of the pre-Clovis sites in the New World. That is just a lower standard of reporting accountability than the private sector has really had since the 80s, at least. Like, I can pull up any random CRM report in the PDF that's like 1,600 pages long. That was for a site that was excavated in 1988, and all those data will be there. And it's just kind of a, it's kind of a shame, actually, like that academic archaeology has lower standards of reporting in that regard than the private sector does.
I was texting with Toon, and it, like, academic archaeology maybe gets the buzz and you think you're the center of the universe of all things archaeology, but what CRM I've done mostly in the Southwest, you realize how much, like, that archaeology was so much money on the line. Like, no one's having hearings in Congress about Monteverde. They are having
they might be in Chile now.
Yeah, they are having hearings in Congress about Section 106 because there are millions and billions of dollars in projects on the line. And so, I don't know, I just feel like something like Monteverde gets this lion's share of the view, but there are CRM, like the world that somebody like Stu Fidel was working, like, in writing reports for Lewis Berger and other people, like, the stakes are, it's not like he's like toiling away like in meaningless CRM land and daring the challenge. Like, he was, there's some skin in the game that's above and beyond a science article. Like, it could be millions of dollars in lawsuits if something's done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm blowing that out of proportion or whatever, but I always felt like that knock against Stu wasn't fair.
I can tell you, with a dozer breathing behind your neck when you're doing CRM, it's always stressful because, you know, if, like, you find something, these guys are going to hate you and possibly run you over. So I don't know if that helps.
If you don't find it, you destroy the past.
Yeah. So it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Well, why I bring this up is it reminds me of when I was in grad school, and this is like a slight tangent. When I was in grad school, I worked on a survey project outside Superior, Arizona, doing a survey for mining pads in copper country. And then they said they were going to do drilling. I was like, how in the world are you guys going to drill up here? They're like, oh, we're going to fly in the drilling pads by helicopter. And then they come to find out they were a small company, and this multi-billion-dollar mining industry. The reason why they're even testing there is one of the biggest copper mine finds of all time was in the next valley over. And that was the one that John McCain basically did the Oak Flats land swap to basically give this multinational corporation mining rights out from under, I think, the Apache. And so, like, we were the rounding error on the rounding error, the rounding error of a big giant machine. It made you feel like you're sitting in the ocean and you know there are big sharks underneath you. And if something screws up, that whole chain, and you're talking lots of money down the line that could be slowed up. And that's the world that Stu Fidel operates in. So I don't know. That's a defense of Stu in that sense.
I need to get him on at some point so the audience can know more about who he is. Maybe we'll talk about the dog paper. A question of our last 10 minutes here, I'll shift towards, is I mentioned in the beginning of the video that I do disagree with Todd on things here and there. And I have, my gut tells me that the kelp highway makes sense. Like, why wouldn't people be coming down with boats and whatnot? But Todd's answer to me, this is like a debate in front of like the field school students, was like, what proof do you have? You know, just show me the evidence. Where is it? It's all underwater. What proof do you have? And I was like, well, I guess genetics. And he was like, well, I can't remember how that went. But to me, it's like, theoretically, that should be possible. But the overwhelming evidence does come through the ice-free corridor for me. What levels of evidence do you guys need to see for something like the Kelp Highway or something other than the ICF? And like with sites like Monteverde, or let's say Galt or Meadowcroft or Paisley Cave or Pooper's Ferry, what would you like to see in future pre-Clovis sites? I think this is one of the questions in the paper I wrote down.
I mean, I would like to see pre-Clovis sites of the type that we see in Alaska, mm-hmm. south of the ice sheets. That's it. It's really simple. Buried sites with a bunch of artifacts and features, obviously butchered faunal remains, solid radiocarbon dates. There's a lot of those sites in eastern Beringia in Alaska where you'd expect them to be. And there's none of them south of the ice sheets. That's it. It's not that much to ask, honestly. Like, there's all the pre-Clovis sites that have been proposed are just weird. They all have their own weird thing. They're not a normal hunter-gatherer campsite. And that's all I want to see. So that's
devil's advocate to that. If it's a founding population coming in on foot, my opinion would be that you would need to see stone tools and need to see evidence of them being here. But a lot of comments I've seen is if it's a small colonizing population that eventually turns into Clovis, wouldn't it make sense you don't see much stuff?
It doesn't make sense that the archaeological record would be fundamentally different from everything that came before or after it. No. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that. There's no reason to believe that, in my opinion. Okay.
That's exactly, you know, my issue. I'm agnostic. I do not care one way or the other, Clovis first or pre-Clovis, right? I'm just in it for the love of the game. And I just want to see a pre-Clovis site that isn't weird, that doesn't have some really strange anomaly to it, right? That everything is hinging upon this one outlier that we never see on another archaeological site anywhere else. Yeah. And, you know, again, further to piggyback on what Spencer was saying, we can look at other places around the world. This isn't existing in a vacuum, right? The Americas. We can see how colonization, peopling of new lands plays out in all over the world. Right. Oftentimes it's compared. The Americas are compared to Australia. We have interesting things happening in Madagascar. I personally work on initial human colonization of Ireland and Northern Europe. And we don't see those weird, anomalous sites and, quote, archaeological records in these other geographic contexts. It's only here for some reason in the Western Hemisphere, and I have a very difficult time squaring that.
Yeah. Dr. Gover, tokenize, but...
No, I mean, like, I'm kind of there with Jesse, and, like, you know, Pawnee oral traditions don't talk about coasts. Like, we're very firm on a time of ice.
You're
monsters.
In the middle of the continent.
Yeah, like, and I think Pawnees have been in the middle of the continent for a very long time. But, like, I'm pretty sure we were one of those migrations that came through the ice-free corridor. That's what our oral traditions state. But, I mean, like, that idea of, like, is the ice-free corridor, A, was it open, and B, was it then biologically viable? That's going to have to be a geology question. Archaeology is not going to be able to answer that. I know it flip-flops, but I'm just not as well-versed. I mean, it's a fun debate. White sands still, is it sloths? Who knows?
Stuck in Miller's.
I don't know, man.
It's some new thing nobody even knows about yet.
Right. And then the genetics are also out there, but all, you know, there's the genetic piece of it, but also like our genetic library is also not that big at the same time. Like there's a missing genetic population that involves Central America somehow. Like there's so many more. This puzzle that we have to deal with is so incomplete, right? Like the nature of archaeology, like we're already dealing with a fragmented record. Like we don't have all the evidence. We'll never have all the evidence, whether it is rising coastlines or like in the case of the plains, there's been so much geologic turnover here. Like sites are buried. Like it's hard to find Clovis sites or Paleo-Indian sites in the Great Plains because they're like 5-6 meters under the surface. Right. So just the nature of the field, man, like finding the earth, we'll never find the earliest site and we won't find the most. We won't find many of the sites. So I don't know. it's a fun exercise. I don't take it too personally. Like, I don't hold the Clovis pre-Clovis debate dearly. That's not what we're in the field for. We're just trying to figure out the best we can. And so, like, how heated this debate has gotten has really, like, it's fun to like have beers with you guys and talk about it and talk about evidence, but just some of the visceral reactions online to this paper or this debate, they're just kind of disgusting.
It won't be so fun if you disagree with us, Carlton.
I know. I'm just, I like my corn. I like my pots.
Hope you like your knees intact.
Yeah, right.
It's not just online, right? I mean, these are visceral, you know, attacks that get taken personally in person, in publications and conferences, right?
One thing I just want to mention this real quick. Every time I see this hit the popular media, there's this line that's like, oh, people have had their careers ruined over pursuing their belief that pre-Clovis occupations exist. Their lives have been destroyed. They've had their careers ruined. They've lost their jobs. And you don't have to name any names, but I am curious among this group, do you know of anybody for which that's true? Has that actually happened, or is that just like a talking point that comes out in these kind of acrimonious debates every few years?
I think it's just a talking point.
Yeah. And most of those people probably lost it for like misconduct in other ways.
Yeah.
I've never even heard a rumor of a specific name or a specific example about that, right? It's
I haven't either.
The legend of the guy with the hook, you know, going by the cars or something, you know.
I mean, my impression is it's a complete straw man that was kind of propped up as like kind of this woe is me, we've been persecuted for these beliefs forever. I just don't think that's true. Like and it drives like an unnecessary wedge between these two camps, if you even want to call them that. It's like, no, we're not ruining, nobody wants to ruin anybody's life over this. We're just doing science and trying to find the truth about this stuff.
I mean, like the only, you know, debate surrounding this is like when the white nationalist group tries to uplift Solutrean to validify the genocide of Native American peoples. Like, I think that's like the worst it gets. But beyond that, like the pre-Clovis Clovis debate, like, yeah. I don't think anyone's life has been ruined over it. That's kind of ridiculous, but
it ruined my life
in the good way.
I got a Clovis first lower back tat. I'll have to get covered up.
I did see a comment today saying, and it's along that same vein. It's like this Surreville guy has been at it his whole life, being a pre-Clovis denier. He's terrified of losing funding. And like, if pre-Clovis exists, he'll like be fired. And I was like, Todd does plenty of other work that he was in Mongolia. Like, I don't.
How do people believe that? Like,
I think it's Hancock and Rogan. And
I want to make him a shirt that says pre-Clovis denier. I listen to that name.
Yeah. And then another comment I got was saying, like, you need to be careful because like, the implications of what you're saying could like harm indigenous people. And I'm like, well, Carl, fine.
Yeah. Like you actually ask Native people, like, what are their origin stories? And you're going to get a wide variety, dude.
Cause there's a lot over of them, 200 nations for me to ask, you know, and they're all going to be differing.
You know, so now there's 576 tribes, but the vast majority of tribal oral traditions over coming, being here can be archaeologically threaded together. So, I mean, like, the vast majority of people that say dumb shit like that have never actually talked to a Native person, or if they have, they're a generic here or pretendian who doesn't actually know.
I'd like to touch on the finance thing real quick, though. Like, idea that if Todd doesn't stand for Clovis first, he's going to lose all his funding and his job. I just want to call to attention that, like, pre-Clovis archaeology has garnered by far more funding than any other focus of North American archaeology in the last decade, 15, 20 years. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of financial resources funneled towards that, to the point where I think you could defensively and accurately say if some folks stopped looking for pre-Clovis archaeology, then they would lose funding. I think that's a true statement in some cases, especially when you get endowments that are specifically given to you with the stated purpose of finding pre-Clovis sites, or you have private donors, they get interested in this and they say, we want you to find a pre-Clovis site. that has actually happened. What has not happened is that people are just funding a narrative of Clovis first and threatening to pull finances away from them if you deviate from that narrative. That is not true. But you can actually point at like receipts. There are receipts to back up the notion that the search for pre-Clovis archaeology is extremely well funded by people invested in proving that's true.
Which is an inherent bias when you're digging and looking and you're going to find.
It's insane to me that that narrative has become so inverted, because I mean, it's just the exact opposite of the actual truth of the matter.
Well, I mean, that's how we ended up here, right? Like when they sent that team down to Monteverde in the 90s, it was on a private jet by a funder with the explicit purpose of, you guys are going to go down there and you are all going to reach consensus and solve this shit. Yeah. Yep. Wow. And so when the two Clovis first guys were in the pit looking at the stratigraphy and the pre-Clovis guys are above them with shovels, there's an implication, but like the part of that was they had to come to a consensus, right? So even that process of deciding Monteverde legit or not, there was that pressure behind it.
Like, yeah. I'm not going to say much more about it because that kind of gets nasty, but I really obviously don't like that narrative at all, that there's this like secret cabal of Clovis Firsters funding debunking these sites. It's just complete bullshit. It's
well, Clovis Firsters are the minority. Yeah. You know, like, do essentially the minority, and I'm Batoon. I'm agnostic. I don't give a shit. Like, what where's the good science? And right now, like, a lot of the best sites are Clovis sites.
We're rolling good now, David. You're about to cut us off. I can see it in your eyes.
I know. Well, I have to. We could do like 5 more minutes max, but I forgot to do ad breaks in the middle of this. I'm sorry, Chris. I'm sorry, Rachel. Please don't hurt me. Yeah, I was going to ask if anyone has any closing thoughts and closing statements, but please, whatever you guys were going with there, continue, because I can tell you're fired up, but you are.
No, I said my piece.
Okay.
I just really hate that. The idea that Clovis, people that want to find Clovis archaeology are being bought off to do it. It's just so utterly crazy. From a guy, one more thing, from Graham Hancock, who has 2 seasons of Netflix deals under his belt. How rich do you think that dude is? Like, come on. We're out here like how many grants do you think Leprell had to scrape together to like fund the excavation of an actual Clovis site? I think we got 6 different grants from 6 different entities to scrape together enough money to pull that off. Yeah, it just pisses me off, man. We work really hard to get the funds to do that shit and to be told that it's like all coming from secret cabal is not cool.
Yeah. And we had to, at Leprell, go to town to haul water in jugs. It's not like we're like living in luxury either. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know. Toon, do you got anything?
You know, I'll just close by saying again, I and we've already talked about it. The takeaway is that it was independent confirmation or an attempt thereof that Surville and colleagues, you know, went down there and they did. To me, that speaks volumes. And, you know, I don't like or dislike any sites. I literally have no feelings about a site or a theory either way. I'm just inherently interested in this. And in this being archaeology and late Pleistocene Ice Age topics. And I think too many times people in the field, but also people listening and reading stuff online get caught up in this weird issue of how they feel about something and where someone's agenda is coming from. Like, I don't care, and I have increasingly little patience for that.
Fair enough. Dr. Miller?
I got lots of thoughts, but I'll try to be concise here.
Yeah.
I think I make jokes about being pretty partisan. And I guess in some way I kind of am. And that's come from years and years of just having your heart broke whenever you pop the hood on these pre-Clovis sites and you're like, okay, this is not what I initially thought it was going to be. And that started with me like working at Topper when I was a youngster. But that being said, I think like on a positive note, there's a lot of people that I disagree with that I still read and I still value their opinion. And I might disagree with them on maybe some interpretation of a site, but I don't disagree with them on everything that they do. So, for example, Vance Holliday and I, like, who, you know, he's one of the people on White Sands. We might not agree about White Sands, but we agree on a lot of things. I might disagree with David Meltzer on some things. I still acknowledge that he's a very highly intelligent man who's done an incredible amount of high quality field work. And he's a nice guy, and he's a solid researcher. The people that I like to read that I think that I have that have a really good holistic grasp, and like whenever they start talking, I shut up and I just want to just like listen. Kelly Graff at Kansas. Anytime she gives a talk, I feel like she's got her head around archaeology and peopling stuff in a way that's very holistic. Ben Potter is in that category. And then in the Southeast, Ashley Smallwood and Jesse Halligan. Like those two, like I agree with them on a lot of things. I work with them on a lot of things. I disagree with them on a lot of things. But whenever they start talking, I shut up and listen just because they're very bright, very bright, and I value their opinions. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a little more of that, of just like acknowledging that we're all human here and we're all just doing our best. And there's not really sides to this.
Yeah.
Amen to that for sure.
Dr. Gover, do you have anything there too?
Yeah, I think if you're going to go to grad school, go to a different PhD program than your master's, get a holistic background. I think for me, what I noticed, a lot of people that are I become disappointed with have stayed in the same program their entire career. I think I benefited academically and professionally from going to Wyoming for my master's and being around Todd and Bob and Spencer and all these other folks. And then that's a huge, we look for elephants and Clovis first. Then going to Boulder, which was mostly like Mesoamericanists and Southwesterners, and I'm sitting there learning about temples and ritual and a lot more post-processual. And like, I got both ends of the spectrum, and I feel like I can understand, I have a better grasp of a lot of things. So I can see both arguments in archaeology from a lot of different ways. And so like, and having taken two graduate level archaeological theory classes from two very different perspectives have helped me. So like, I don't know, just expand your horizons. Like, this is fun. I think this paper is awesome. Science published it. Like, this isn't nature. This isn't the archaeological section of nature. This is science. Like this, I think this is helping a lot, and it's stimulating conversation again. And I really do hope that we use this as a case study for how to remind archaeologists that if we are going to be a capital S science, science is, what's the word for it?
Candle in the darkness.
Candle in the darkness, and it progresses on itself. It self-transforms. Like, that's the whole purpose. It's not a one and done. We have to go back. And I think a lot of people on this panel have gone back and revisited sites and taken new approaches to previous data to get new interpretations. Like, that's the whole purpose of our field. So like, this isn't nothing new. So this is cool. Good job, Todd and crew, and all the collaborators, right? Like, let's not forget that there is a whole team of Chileans that contributed to this. Yeah. Right? Like,
Claudio, who's the other guy's name?
Cesar, right?
Cesar Mendez, Claudio Latorre, and there's another couple other guys.
Juan Luis Garcia. That's
right. Spencer, did I ask you closing statements yet? Did you already say it? I can't recall. 10 minutes ago.
My only closing statement, I guess, would be like, good science should inspire conversations among people, regardless if they're civil or acrimonious or whatever. And this has certainly done that. And I'm just glad we're like talking about it again, instead of just kind of steadily drifting into further and further away camps about peopling America's issues. So I don't know if there's a Paleo American Odyssey conference is in October. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I'm going to come to that. I need to see the flights.
I'm going
to
go. I wasn't thinking about going, but I was like, I'm going to be there. I will be in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
They're setting up the UFC octagon, I think, like inside the conference.
Rogan there. And Hancock are announcing it. Yeah.
That's just right on the plaza, right on the plaza downtown.
The tamales I got there were
wild. It's going to be an Adobe octagon because the city requires that.
Yeah. What was that joke?
You should set up a booth and interview people while you're there and get some sweet content.
That's actually a wonderful idea, but Dillahaye is going to come find me.
That's even better. Yeah, that's going to.
Yeah, I want to have him on. I think I should.
What if he does?
When his stuff's out.
If he's not an adult, that's his problem.
Yeah, It's very true. I'm excited to see Stu. The tamales downtown were spectacular. And yeah. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for having on. This was Dr. Jesse Toon. This was Dr. Shane Miller, Dr. Carlton Shield Chief Gover, and Dr. Spencer Pelton. You can find all their contact information below in the YouTube description or in the show notes of the podcast. Please remember to rate and view the podcast. DavidandHow.com for all your merchandise. I am launching a course next week with Fluent Pet that will be dropping on the 30th, but you'll get more information on that later. And yeah, please comment, review, and YouTube comments, YouTube likes, that whole thing. And Carlton, any closing words about the Lakota?
No, I'm not. Okay, <time. laughs>
we are good. All right.
Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarchpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.